From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And on this Memorial Day, when we remember fallen soldiers, we're also remembering the almost 100,000 Americans lost so far in the pandemic. And we're keeping an eye on crowded beaches, hoping they don't lead to more.
At the same time, workers are optimistic that a careful reopening will mean a return to a paycheck rather than an unemployment check. Republicans and Democrats are still divided on whether more aid to businesses and families will be needed and what shape any new relief package would take. But Derek Thompson says when Congress returns to work, much more money will be needed to be spent to avoid another Great Depression. He's senior editor at The Atlantic and joins us from Washington as he does each Monday. Derek, make your case. You say $10 trillion in total spending is necessary.
Yeah, I want to first acknowledge that I imagine a lot of people listening to the number $10 trillion are thinking, excuse me, what? $10 trillion? How could that possibly work? So let me just quickly walk through the numbers. We've spent about $3 trillion so far. That includes the CARES Act that was passed in March. But people are still struggling. You have widespread business failure, and you also have state and local governments who, because people aren't buying stuff and often aren't earning as much money because they're unemployed or furloughed, aren't going to get income tax from a lot of their citizens. So I think we need another across-the-board multi-trillion dollar bill that would include money for families, extended unemployment benefits. It would include bailouts for many small businesses, and it would include about $500 billion for state and local governments. And I think it could require another several hundred billion dollars more for hospitals, rural areas, treatments, antivirals, and vaccine research. So I want us to develop the kind of civic stomach for the possibility that over the next few years, we might have to spend the equivalent of $10 trillion.
But what about people who worry about the debt, about somebody who is going to have to pay that money down many years from now, maybe even decades from now? Why saddle the future generations with so much debt?
Yeah, it's a really important question to address. First, the United States does not borrow money the same way that a family borrows money from a bank. We control our own currency. We can authorize spending without necessarily raising the equivalent in taxes and run a deficit. I think more generally, a lot of people are worried about future inflation, future debt. Well, We're suffering a once-in-a-century drought right now, and worrying about future taxes and future inflation and future debt incurrence is a little bit like trying to fix a drought and watering your crops and worrying, well, what happens if there's a terrible flood in the near future? Well, we need to address the problem that we have without worrying too much about the problems that we might have if we fix what's wrong with the economy and the virus today in 2020.
Now, what about the argument that has been made by Republicans, including the White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow, who told CNN earlier this month that the White House was on a pause, that it makes sense to pause right now before any more relief comes from Congress? Listen.
We put up $3 trillion of direct federal budget assistance in one way or another. Let's see how it's doing as we gradually reopen the economy.
Now, we've heard this from lawmakers we've spoken to as well, Derek. What about that idea? Wait, let's see what happens, and then maybe there's more money coming.
I would say that Washington might think that they have time to pause, but families right now who are unemployed and might not be able to pay rent in August, they can't afford to pause. State and local governments are in the process of constructing budgets for 2021, for fiscal year 2021, and they're looking at incoming tax revenue that's been utterly obliterated because of the decline in sales tax revenue and income tax revenue. None of these groups have the luxury of pausing. You know, the unemployment insurance benefit bump up of $600 per week that was passed earlier this year, that's going to run out in the middle of the summer. So I think it's a little bit of a fantasy to think that we have that much time to just wait around and see what's going to happen. We know what is happening. We can see the suffering that's happening right now, and we need to act on it.
And what about people who say, well, then just let things open up instead of having Congress come to the rescue?
Yeah, this is a really complicated argument, and I think it has to do with a bit of a misnomer about opening up. It's not as if state and local governments or President Trump have like a garage door opener that they can push and just say, boom, I press the button, the economy is open. You know, citizens are co-openers and co-closers of the economy. If they don't feel safe in bars and restaurants and stores and stadiums, they're not going to go, whether or not the doors are chained. In some parts of the country, you see people starting to go back to these places because they're looking around and they're not afraid of the local outbreak. Or maybe in some places like Idaho and Montana, the local outbreak actually is pretty small. But there's lots of other places where there is a live outbreak right now. And as a result, families, no matter what their governors or mayors are saying, are staying put. We have to solve the virus problem before we can fully solve the economic problem. Both of those problems take money, and both of them require spending that can be authorized today.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's go to Brazil now to get reaction to the new U.S. travel ban on foreign nationals coming to the U.S. if they've been in Brazil in the last 14 days. The White House announced the ban last night because Brazil now has the second highest number of coronavirus infections in the world, more than 360,000, and President Trump had already banned travel from the U.K., Europe, and China. But if Brazil is second in the world in cases, the U.S. is first. The BBC's Katie Watson joins us now from Sao Paulo. She's on Skype. Katie, has the government there reacted to this travel ban by the Trump administration?
Well, Jair Bolsonaro on Twitter, which is one of his most popular platforms for talking to the public, he only retweeted somebody called Felipe Martins, who is a special advisor to the presidency. He's an international politics professor. And he effectively tweeted that this restriction is actually just similar to previous restrictions based on people coming from all sorts of countries, saying that it's not effectively a political decision. This is just about keeping people safe. He said that it's not preventing commerce, reiterating, of course, what Donald Trump has said. So they are taking it certainly publicly, saying that this is not a political issue, that we don't need to worry about this, because, of course, Donald Trump is a massive influence on Jair Bolsonaro. So even if this is a question of just keeping people safe, I'm sure it is certainly going to be stinging the government right now.
Yes, stinging is the appropriate word. And you mentioned that the Brazilian president tweeted about this. That's one thing he has in common with President Trump. But other comparisons are being made between Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro and President Trump. The Guardian has this headline, Putin, Johnson, the UK, Bolsonaro and Trump, men too macho for masks. Now, there's footage of Bolsonaro surrounded by supporters recently. He's not wearing a mask. President Trump doesn't want to wear a mask. Are there Brazilians who think that this ban is maybe a little hypocritical, given that the U.S. has more cases than Brazil does?
I mean, I just think Bolsonaro is so along the same lines as Donald Trump that they're not going to be outraged by this, certainly publicly, because they want to stay friends with him. They love him. Jair Bolsonaro wants more than anything for the economy to reopen. I mean, that's what we see every single weekend. We see him going down to meet his supporters who have come to protest against isolation measures. As you mentioned, he doesn't like wearing a mask. Occasionally he does, but he certainly makes a statement by trying not to. And he's made several public statements about how this virus is like a little flu, like the sniffles. I mean, he does his very best to downplay the virus at a time when the numbers keep on climbing. And Brazilians are looking to Jair Bolsonaro, certainly for leadership, and realizing they can't get it. That said, he still does have core supporters who feel that the measures brought in by the state governors in terms of quarantine in some places, tougher lockdowns, that they are unnecessary. They're more damaging to the economy than they need to be. And Brazil will suffer as a result.
We've seen on American television some of those state governors stand up and say Bolsonaro has to stand down. He's not handling this appropriately. So you have the same tensions there that you have in some corners here in the U.S. But why the spike in cases there? Is it because people don't get the sense they have to do the social distancing or wear masks? Why the spike?
I think there's both political and social reasons. Of course, political reasons being the confusion. You've got the president saying, get back to normal. Let's not worry about the virus. People are going to get it anyway. You've got the state governor saying, don't listen to him. You need to have much tougher rules. Certainly here in São Paulo, the numbers of people who are still isolating are lower than they need to be to contain the virus. On the other hand, social issues. I mean, for a start, the country is not testing very much. The scientists who are modelling the shape of the curve say that they don't know where Brazil is on the curve, the real numbers could be 12, 15 times higher than the official figures. And that's very worrying. But also, this is a country that's deeply unequal. There's a lot of poverty. So people who are in wealthier neighborhoods with big houses can isolate quite happily. But there are favelas, there are poorer neighborhoods mm-hmm. where people live, you know, six, seven, more to, you know, one or two rooms. And they say that the rules that are being brought in don't apply to them because they cannot social distance. Mm-hmm. They cannot wash their hands like they've been asked to do. And I think that's a big concern, too.
Yeah, in the favelas. The BBC's Katie Watson in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Katie, thank you.
Thanks.
Native American tribes in the Southwest have been hit hard by the coronavirus. The Navajo Nation has the highest rate of cases per capita in the U.S. A lack of running water, many generations living together, and a chronically underfunded healthcare system have helped COVID-19 spread. A GoFundMe campaign to support Native communities has raised more than $4 million, and some of those donations are coming from Ireland. Reciprocation for an act of kindness from a century ago. Laurel Morales from member station KJZZ explains.
To make room for the country's westward expansion, the federal government forced the Choctaw and other Native American tribes from their homelands in the southeast United States and resettled them west of the Mississippi in the 1800s. The ordeal was called the Trail of Tears, as thousands died during the migration. Choctaw archaeologist Deanna Bird.
And we experienced extreme hardship and loss and disease and hunger and disconnect from our homeland.
The Choctaw wound up in Oklahoma, rebuilt their lives, and planted corn, beans, and squash. At the same time, Ireland was in the middle of a potato famine. People were starving. 1 million died. The General Irish Relief Committee, based in New York, traveled the country raising funds and came to the Choctaw Council for help. Bird says Choctaw families collected $170, about $5,000 in today's dollars. She believes her ancestors could relate to those in need.
Our hearts really went out to the families that we knew were starving. We recognized and we understood that hunger, the loss of generations, the elderly, the children. This loss really resonated with us.
Now, generations later, hundreds of Irish men, women, and children are donating money, anywhere from $5 to $100, to help Native families. Aaron Doyle is from County Wexford in Ireland.
Although many years later, the help is never forgotten. A lot of us Irish have donated back under similar circumstances.
Doyle says the Irish aren't immune to the pandemic.
Self and a lot of us here in my community have lost our jobs as a result of the COVID-19, but it doesn't mean we can't come together and help each other in difficult times.
Along with their donations, people have left messages like returning the kindness shown to us and the people in Ireland remember. Choctaw author Waylon Whitedeer says there is no favor to return, just a continuation of kindness.
We say that, the greatest thing you can do for someone is to feed them because you're extending human life. That's what that original donation did, and now, we can see that, it's moved on.
Campaign co-lead Vanessa Tooley, who is Navajo, helps coordinate the donations.
That's just the basic principles of care based on family. Family doesn't just extend to your blood relatives, but it extends to your community members. And we've got to treat everyone like they're our dear family members.
Tooley says she wants the people of Ireland to know that their donations are being spent wisely, buying food boxes for Native elders and those who are immunocompromised. For Here and Now, I'm Laurel Morales.
Well, lockdowns are being lifted in parts of the country, but summer camps and vacations are being canceled in others. So how to transport kids when they can't go anywhere? Well, books. Books can take you away from your everyday life or validate it. although not for everyone. And that lack of diversity has inspired Scholastic to create a new collection of books for Black and Latino boys in K-5 classrooms. By the way, they hope to include Native American-centered books in the next collection. Parents will post a link at herenow.org where you can see some of the titles, or educators can order the whole collection before the school year starts. It's called The Rising Voices Library. It was curated by David C. Banks, principal of the Eagle Academy Foundation and the founding principal of the Eagle Academy for Young Men, the first all-boys public high school in New York City. David, welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we have Andrea Davis-Pinckney, Vice President and Executive Editor at Scholastic, also the author of numerous books for children. Andrea, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Robin. Nice to be here. And hello, David.
Hello, Andrea.
We're all hooked up with technology here. But Andrea, you start. When I say there wasn't enough diversity, that young boys of color in particular don't have books that reflect their image, how bad is it?
Well, Robin, it's absolutely true that there's the dearth of diversity. You know, I look at the library from the standpoint of a mom. I'm African-American. I have an African-American son. What's particularly relevant to me about the library are some of the themes of the books: family, culture, heroes, role models. And those are things that are just ongoing and relevant.
Yeah. And is it also that he might see someone who looks like him?
Exactly. You know, I always say kids see what they see and they don't see what they don't see. So when I see a face on the cover of a book that looks like my face, I feel good about myself. I have agency and I want to read more books.
And David Banks, I should say Principal Banks, you curated this. Give us some of the titles, 300 of them. What are some of the titles? And tell us more about why, what they were reflecting for you.
Well, you know, Robin, as an African-American, when I was a little boy growing up, it was extremely rare to find books that had young men that looked like me as the protagonist in the books. And so when you look at a collection like Rising Voices, and there really isn't another one like it really anywhere in the country, there are titles like A Journey to the Ballot Box. It's a story about a little boy as he growing up in the rural South as he watched his grandfather try to vote for the first time and was turned away because of barriers that were put in place, like literacy tests. And Bippity Bop Barbershop, one of my favorite stories about a little boy going to get a haircut at the local barbershop with his dad. And it's his real fear getting his first haircut. And it's kind of a rite of passage story. And I think really one of my favorite books in the collection is called La Frontera. And it's the story of a young man who migrates with his father from Mexico to Texas. And it's very, very powerful. And those are just a handful of the titles that are in the collection.
Yeah. And Andrea, you're an author, as well, as we mentioned, in one of your books, Sit In, How Four Friends Stood Up by Sitting Down. It's part of this collection. It celebrates the 50th anniversary of the stage sit-in at a segregated Woolworth lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina. Some of us might have grown up with that, but you know, some kids may never have heard of it. I'm just going to read a little bit from it. This is page 5. David, Joseph, Franklin, and Izelle sat while everyone else got served. At first, they were treated like the hole in a donut, invisible. Others tried to ignore them. The waitress watched and refused them. This was a sign of the times, whites only. So this is clear-eyed.
Yes, yes. You know, it's so interesting with sit-in. The themes of the book are core to the themes of the Rising Voices Library, which I'm so thrilled sit-in is part of that collection. And when I present it in schools, the students love the themes. And I think whether it's 2020 or 1960, the bottom line is feeling good about your actions and doing the right thing.
Well, you know, it strikes me too, David, maybe you want to pick this up, that it could be, you know, 1960, it could be today. It could be a Black child or a white child that would benefit from looking through this prism. I mean, when I think that we had Dick and Jane and Spot, you know, white kids, and, you know, when I think that young white children growing up in America didn't have these stories either, that also seems unfair.
It is unfair because the whole purpose of education is to really help us to have a better understanding of all of those who are around us. And so the literature ought to reflect that. A collection like Rising Voices really does help all children have a deeper respect and a deeper understanding. That's what helps us to be better Americans because we know each other just that much better.
Well, plus it's a good story. These are good stories, you know. Why
These
deprive any?
That's right.
Yeah, deprive any kid of a good story.
The other thing I think is very important is that in the Rising Voices Library, 85% of the books, they are written by authors. They are illustrated by artists who are of the same ethnic origin as the characters in the books.
Yeah, as we said, 300 titles. There's also storage bins and book stickers and teacher's guides and teaching cards. It's a whole package, and we'll link people to where they can learn more about it for their schools. But David, as a principal, just what would you want to tell teachers about how they might integrate this into their curriculum?
You know, teachers, I think, are just critically, you know, we talk about essential workers. They are essential. They are essential to the success and the future of our nation. And so we have found as we have traveled around the country that the teachers have been so excited. They've been looking for resources with these very powerful stories that help them to figure out how to better engage all of their students. We're bringing a very unique collection to school systems all across the nation, and people are ready for it and looking for it.
And this is something you've put together for schools, but you know, parents are home with their kids right now, so we want to let them know. We'll link them up to a website where they can go see at least the titles and get some of them for their kids, and then push their schools to get these special collections when schools start back up again.
This is a great opportunity to prevent something that is known as the summer slide, which is the slide off that kids experience from not reading during the school year. Now that we're home, we can read together and keep those skills strong.
And there's plenty of books for everybody.
Right.
Andrea Davis Pinckney, Vice President and Executive Editor at Scholastic, and David C. Banks, Principal of the Eagle Academy Foundation and the founding principal of the Eagle Academy for Young Men, curator of this collection we've been talking about. I want to thank you both so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
The Atlantic hurricane season begins next week on June 1st, and this year the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is predicting an above average 13 to 19 named storms, of which 3 to 6 could be major hurricanes. For more, we're joined now by Jeff Huffman, Director and Chief Meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Jeremy.
So the hurricane season officially begins June 1st, but it is typically busiest in August. And NOAA says it will update its outlook later in the summer. But tell us more about what they're predicting at this point and how it compares to other years.
Well, the big headline this year is that the forecast, not only from NOAA, but from several other private agencies, is for a busy year in terms of the number of storms, several factors leading into that. But, you know, an average hurricane season, we normally see around 12 named storms. All the forecasts that I'm seeing and all the indications are that we're going to have more storms than normal over the entire Atlantic basin. We've already had our first named storm, Arthur, of course, brushed by the Carolinas last week. And that's the sixth year in a row a storm has formed before the official storm. Start of the season.
So what are the reasons that you're talking about for a busier season this year?
Well, the water temperatures are glaringly warm, if that's a word. They are above normal across most of the Atlantic and especially closer to the North American continent in waters like the Gulf of Mexico, the Western Caribbean. We've got above normal sea surface temperatures, and the long-range forecast is for those to continue. There also is the concern that a La Nina is developing. That's the opposite of El Nino. It's actually a cooling of the eastern Pacific waters, and if that were to occur, and chances for that occurring are just above 50% right now, that could also correlate to more activity in the Atlantic Ocean during the heart of the hurricane season. It leads to less wind shear or lighter winds aloft across areas where hurricanes tend to form that time of year. That's something we may not know much more about until maybe later in June or July, but right now all factors are pointing to a busy season in the Atlantic.
Now, are people already talking about how they would deal with both preparation and response to a major hurricane where you are in Florida or anywhere else for that matter in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic? How does that complicate the efforts?
Well, yeah, it's difficult to kind of think about that, but it certainly could happen. We work with a lot of emergency managers here in the state of Florida, and there are plans being put into place that include more shelters. There are plans being worked on that, of course, would accommodate any evacuees that may test positive for the virus. It's complicated, no doubt. I think one of the big things we're hearing here in Florida, and I want to emphasize that we always talk about know your zone, know your evacuation zone, because if you are told to evacuate, we strongly encourage that. But officials are going to be also reminding us to look at your home, find out what your building codes are in your neighborhood, discover if you can the type of construction you have, and learn what type of wind speeds your home can withstand, because in addition to, of course, encouraging evacuations, emergency managers here in Florida are also encouraging residents, if they can stay put and shelter at home and they have confidence in their structure surviving, say, a Category 1 or Category 2 storm, they're going to be strongly encouraged to do so, of course, because that will cut down on the potential complications with the COVID recovery.
That is Jeff Huffman, who is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, thanks so much, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you if this season is as busy as they think it will be.
Sounds good, Jeremy. Thank you.
On this Memorial Day, let's remember a long fight to right an old wrong. In April 1966, members of Charlie Company, a troop of American soldiers with the Army 1st Infantry Division, were tasked with searching out a powerful Viet Cong battalion in Vietnam's dense jungle. Drastically outnumbered, the Americans were soon ambushed and circled in one of the bloodiest operations of the Vietnam War, Abilene. The Viet Cong were at their side, dropping from trees, but then also descending through those trees, a U.S. Air Force pararescuer named William Pitts Pitzenbarger, charged with lifting the injured out. He decided instead to go down himself.
Somebody needs to go down there and get them straightened out. No way, it's hotter than hell down there, Pitts. Those people can't wait, they've lost the medic.
Pitts became one of them, a mud soldier, sending the wounded up to the copter, then waving it off. He'd saved nearly 60 lives before losing his own. Members of Charlie Company, as well as Pitzenbarger's Air Force comrades, spent years trying to get him a posthumous Medal of Honor. It rarely goes to airmen, and in this case, the Pentagon may not have wanted a reminder of that disastrously planned day. But Pitt's friends finally succeeded after 32 years. Their story is told in the film The Last Full Measure, which is streaming now. Earlier this year, writer-director Todd Robinson was in Pitzenbarger's hometown in Ohio for a special screening. That morning, he joined us. And I'm going to disclose right here, one of the reasons I've been following the making of this film is that you hired my brother to be in it, actor John Savage, and thank you for that because it's such a sweet film. But also it's a reminder, he played Steve in The Deer Hunter, and this film does feel as if it's, you know, the characters from that iconic Vietnam War film now in their early 70s.
It does sort of close the loop on that character from The Deer Hunter, for sure.
Yeah, and so we'll talk more about the film. But also with us is Fred Navarro, one of the veterans that Todd Robinson interviewed for the film and also made that fight for Pitts getting the Medal of Honor posthumously. Fred, what did Pitts mean to you? Did you see him on the ground?
Yes. During the lull in the fighting, I heard this whining sound, and then I saw Pitzenbarger coming down through the trees in a litter. No. It was like seeing the angel come down through the jungle to save us, and that's what Pitzenbarger would end up doing.
Yeah. It's just so hard to convey how awful this time was. You guys are surrounded. You've been boxed in, maybe set up. Can you describe how frightening and what a carnage it was?
It was total chaos. Can you imagine 700 guns firing at the same time? And some of us could see the enemy. Most of us could not. It was crazy. But Pitzenbarger was crawling and running, trying to take care of the wounded. He would hear the wounded hollering for help, and he would run to them and take care of them.
With bullets whizzing by him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, you said you became friends. This went on for hours. Enough time to really, you know, bond with this person and also be in awe of him. I mean, did you see him wave away the helicopters?
Yes. the pilot waved Pitzenbarger to get on the litter and let's get out of here. But Pitzenbarger came there to save lives, and that's what he was doing. The PJ model is these things we do so others may live. He waved the pilot off. And to this day, the pilot doesn't know if Pitzenbarger had got in the litter with the two wounded soldiers, if he had been able to lift off or not.
Todd, Fred mentions PJs. Isn't that how you got involved in this before you even knew Pitt's story? You found out about what these people did.
Yeah, they're called pararescue jumpers or pararescue medics, and they're highly trained combat medics, and they're there to evacuate the wounded, tend to their wounds, and as Fred said, these guys will trade their lives for yours. The culture is just replete with stories like this, and it was just irresistible as the subject of a film.
And when you were researching the PJs, you ended up at a base where Pitts's father was speaking, and he said something. I mean, this is a man who'd been mourning the death of his son in Vietnam, and then the fact that he didn't get this medal that so many felt he deserved. And his father said something that also gripped your heart.
He lamented that he had never gotten to see his son fall in love, have a child of his own, because only then could he understand how much his father loved him. And that just knocked me out. I had a 7-year-old son, a 3-year-old daughter at the time, and trying to wrap my head around what it would be like to lose one of them. And then I flash back even further to my own dinner table, where we often watched in the early 1970s the Vietnam War play out on television. And I realized that my father was deeply concerned that I would soon be of draftable age and that he could lose me to something as existentially impossible to deal with as a draft lottery number.
Yeah.
And so when those ideas sort of all came together, it became clear to me that there was a story to tell, and it was the story about not only the combat and the long path to get Pitzenbarger the medal, but it was also about the families that support our fighting men and women.
Yeah. And Fred, it's about what happens to people like you who leave people behind on the battlefield. People have been talking about how Pitts saved lives. One of the things that he did was he'd pull the dead over on top of those who were wounded because the Viet Cong kept coming through and you'd have to play dead on different occasions. But are you one of those that we see in the film has had a very hard time with the fact that you survived and people like Pitts and others didn't?
Yes, I. After I was wounded, the fighting got really bad and Pitzenbarger and I became friends. He always came back to me. He would disappear and take care of the wounded, and he would come back to my location. He took his armored vest off and put it on my chest.
Oh, that's you.
Excuse me. And then he pulled the two dead Americans on top of me. To protect me, and he disappeared again. Later, he would come to my location again, and he would take my rifle and give me his pistol, and that's when he was killed. I wanted to get to him, but because of the weight of the soldiers and my condition, I was unable to get up from under those bodies. And then night fell, and I thought, and I wondered all night if he was alive or not.
Yeah.
And I found out in the morning that he had died.
Yeah.
You know what you can't see, Robin? What you can't see that I can see is that Fred's really full of emotion. And whenever these men are interviewed and asked to talk about this, it actually is traumatic. It brings up all of these feelings over and over again. And so what you're hearing in these delays is really raw emotion.
Yeah. Well, I know you're both in Ohio for a special screening of The Last Full Measure in William Pitzenbarger's hometown of Piqua tonight. That's got to be a delayed homecoming and not the one that everybody would have wanted decades ago. But Fred, I'm imagining you're looking forward to seeing him celebrated tonight.
Oh, yes. There's a lot of veterans that are here today. We came together to honor William Pitzenbauger one more time. It's a sad feeling, but because I've thought about it so many times over the years, but it's a happy feeling to be able to honor William Pitzenbauger once again.
Fred, I want to thank you especially. Thank you so much for talking, no matter how painful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Todd, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Robin.
Todd Robinson, creator of The Last Full Measure, the story of pararescuer William Pitzenbauger, and one of the men Pitz saved, Fred Navarro. We spoke in January. The film is streaming now. And as I always ask on this day, if you happen to be at Long Island Veterans Cemetery, please go by Section V, Site 239B, and salute World War II vet Floyd Jones Youngs for me.
College sports are getting the green light to prepare for the upcoming fall season. The NCAA says all Division I athletes can resume on-campus activities starting June 1st, which means individual workouts and training sessions can start up again. The Big 12 Conference says football workouts will begin on June 12th. Athletes would still have to follow all state and local health requirements. The NCAA is also making preparations to resume championship tournaments this fall after the winter and spring events were canceled. Getting college students back into the classroom is another issue schools are trying to figure out across the country. That includes technical schools, which used to attract students with hands-on training tailored for specific high-demand jobs. In Kansas, the coronavirus pandemic and the state's collapsing aviation industry have hollowed out the promise. Stephen Bisaha of the Kansas News Service reports on how one technical school is handling it.
Let's start with the first part of the tech college pitch, hands-on training.
In all honesty, that was the best part.
It's what convinced Chris Coleman to ditch the beaches of Florida for Wichita State University's Tech College in landlocked Kansas. A scholarship covering moving expenses and tuition helped, but Coleman called the shift from memorizing textbooks to learning by doing a game changer.
They took a guy with zero experience, got an aircraft panel in front of him that was already painted, handed me a sander, and I had to learn, you know, the proper technique of sanding.
After just one semester, he had a job with Textron Aviation, which makes Beechcraft planes and Cessnas. But WSU Tech's hands-on curriculum has been upended by the coronavirus. Aviation Dean James Hall says the school moved some of that training online.
So what my instructors are doing are more or less splitting their classes so that they can do all of the lecture and the level 1 and 2 labs remotely.
But more advanced level 3 labs, where the hands-on stuff is crucial, will have to wait until students can return to campus.
It's really hard to rig an aircraft in a virtual environment.
The college's quick turn certification programs that can take less than 2 months to finish are completely on hold. That's ultimately a short-term problem. A bigger, long-term challenge has to do with the second part of the tech college pitch, training tailored for high-demand jobs. So what happens when those high-demand jobs disappear?
This is a key Boeing supplier. They're issuing a statement today saying they are considering layoffs and potentially...
The grounding of the Boeing 737 MAX has stretched past a year. That, plus the coronavirus, led Wichita's Spirit AeroSystems to lay off about 4,300 workers. And the coronavirus has led to furloughs at Textron Aviation, too. WSU Tech had been a training pipeline for those companies, but now that pipeline is disconnected.
Tech colleges are certainly great when there are lots of jobs and employers are beating down their door.
Lauren Eister is a senior fellow at the Washington, D.C. think tank Urban Institute.
Right now, it's really hard for some industries to think about hiring.
The biggest challenge for tech education right now, it's expensive. When colleges shift to whatever the job market looks like post-coronavirus, they'll have to either find millions of dollars for new equipment or ways to retrofit their old tools. Eister says tech colleges can make the shift. That's because they know what businesses need and have the flexibility to meet those needs quickly.
Tech colleges are able to avoid some of the challenges of traditional higher ed, where curriculum committees and review processes can take a really long time.
Recent WSU Tech graduates trained for jobs that essentially disappeared can get scholarships for retraining. Chris Coleman enrolled in aircraft maintenance classes before he was furloughed by Textron Aviation last month. And despite the hold on some of the hands-on training due to the pandemic, he's on path to get an associate's degree, typically a two-year commitment. But he doesn't plan on stopping there.
Crazy enough, I'm actually looking to stay even longer and then take another program. So I'll have been turning WSU Tech into almost a four-year college.
That might not be the top line of the tech college pitch, but it is one of WSU Tech's goals. Get students into high-earning jobs quickly and keep them coming back for more training so they can adapt to an ever-changing economy. For Here and Now, I'm Stephen Bisaha in Wichita.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. And we don't do it often, but we wanted to take this opportunity on this holiday to credit the Here and Now production team, most of whom have been working from home for some time now. Producers in and around Boston include Karen Miller-Medson, Lynn Menegon, Chico Turi, Ashley Locke, Julia Corcoran, Cassidy Rosenblum, Emiko Tamagawa, Marcel Hutchins, Eileen Balinski, Chris Ballman, Matt Lissette, Serena McMahon, and Allison Hagen, Peter O'Dowd, and Tinku Ray.
But wait, there's more. Our Washington, D.C. team is Sam Rafelson, James Mastromarino, and Lindsay Jeffrey. Chris Bentley is working in Chicago. Jill Ryan has New Haven, Connecticut covered.
And our California team, of course, Tanya Mosley, Christina Kim, and Frankie Paris.
Working in the office, Mark Navin, Alex Ashlock, Todd Munt, James, J.T. Trout, Mike Moschetto, Max Liebman. And the boss of us, our executive producer, is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.